All right, well, glad you guys are here. Let me find out real quick who is here. I was invited to speak to a group in North Carolina last month and didn't know who the group was going to be, and it was kind of a intro to sharing your faith cross-culture, and I got there and like half the group had served as missionaries overseas, so it was probably not the most appropriate thing. But what's our interest in this? I mean, this is kind of a little bit of the missions part. I mean, I'm representing the International Mission Board today, but what is some of the interest? Where are you coming from in terms of this topic? Are you thinking missions? Are you thinking about integrating work and faith, or what's?
I have a nonprofit organization where we have a website where people can, people, missionaries, and organizations submit needs, and then other people that want to help can get on, and we help connect.
Okay, so matching up a little bit. Okay.
And of course, we're a nonprofit too, so we help needs as well.
Okay, so come from that angle. What else?
Interested in business as missions. I'm an engineering student at the University of Louisville right now.
Okay. So what could your career look like in terms of integrating work and faith as an engineer? Yeah, good. Okay. And that's kind of where we're going with this presentation a little bit. But I work for, like I said, the International Mission Board on a relatively new project called Marketplace Advance. And the purpose of Marketplace Advance is to significantly increase the strategic involvement of marketplace professionals in fulfilling the Great Commission. And so what I want to do in our time together today, one, is sort of lay out the case, why we think that's urgent, why we think that's critical, why it's important at this time. And hopefully I do such a good job of that, that then the next obvious question is, well, how do you do it? And then so we'll take a little time. You know, what are some ways we see marketplace professionals really engaging strategically in terms of mission strategy? But I didn't really have a funny story to tell or anything to start this off with, so I had to rely on just to start with a thought-provoking quote. As you can see, the Billy Graham quote up here that says, the next great awakening is likely to take place in the workplace. And it's always a little dangerous. If you notice in most books, they start with a quote, the first chapter or whatever has a little quote. You really don't know the context for it. I really don't know exactly the context of what else Billy Graham said when he said this, but I'm pretty sure he was at least talking about this country. So why do we think Billy Graham would be saying the next great awakening is going to take place in the marketplace? What's going on in this country that would drive that?
People aren't just attending church services for fun anymore.
Okay.
They're not going to just go hear evangelism.
Church has changed. Now, I have lived outside of America pretty much the last 25 years. And so I've just come back in the last year, and I've noticed that while I was gone, things changed. Not like if I had been here, they wouldn't have changed anyway, but things are different. Certainly, church has changed. People don't just go to church. When I was growing up, everybody I knew went to church. In fact, it would have been scandalous if your family didn't at least say you were a member somewhere, but that's not necessarily true. So church life has changed. What about neighborhoods? Have they changed? Moved to Richmond about 3 months ago. I'm still waiting for the first neighbor to bring over the apple pie, the baked goods. And so people don't connect in their neighborhoods the same way they used to. And so what does that leave? Where does everybody go almost every day? Whether they want to or not, they end up going to the marketplace, going to work. They're buyers, they're customers, they're team members. All that happens. And so there's this amazing thing that happens where believers go out into the marketplace every day and engage lost people. And so if you're looking for an awakening to happen, that's probably going to be where you have believers interfacing with lost people in a natural and authentic way. So that's part of we see that same dynamic happening internationally as well. But I want to spend some time this morning saying, what else is happening internationally that we see driving this thing so where we believe the next great awakening are going to happen in the marketplace? So there are five things we want to talk about. One is the persistence of the unfinished task. Well, we'll touch on that briefly. What are we trying to accomplish? And then what are the reasons that are shaping mission strategy? What is changing the demand a little bit in terms of the way that we do missions and who does missions? So we'll talk a little bit about geopolitical restrictions as well as urbanization and the growing middle class. And then the other side here, we're going to talk a little bit about the supply. And we'll obviously have to explain confused identities a little bit when we get there and then look at underutilized kingdom resources. So let's first talk about the task. Now, for the last generation or so, people groups has been the way we've looked at missions. I mean, that's been the way we've talked about it. That's the strategy. And everybody knows what a people group is? I mean, it's largely the largest group of a population segment where the gospel can spread without encountering serious difficulties. Now, what are some of those difficulties we think of in terms of the gospel can't go any further because, yeah, language, culture, geography, those kind of things. So they tell us there's about 11,000 or so people groups out there. But only, well, over half of those 6,000 are considered unreached, meaning less than 2% are evangelical. Below 2%, that threshold, it's a bit like there's not enough critical mass, not enough momentum to reach the rest of the population. And unfortunately, it's not like there are 6,434 people groups where they're at 1.8%, 1.9%. They're almost ready to tip. There are a lot of people groups that are a lot closer to zero than 2%. So we look at that and we say, even with all of the advances, all of the effort and lives and money that we've put into missions with all of the new technologies and communication, how are we doing? We almost got it knocked out. Looks like we still got a long way to go in that. And then even perhaps a little more troubling is that about half of those unreached people groups are considered unengaged, meaning that we don't know of any evangelical group that is actively targeting those people. Now, people groups can range from tens of millions to, you know, a few thousand. Now, most of the big people groups are being targeted, but there are a lot of small groups that are not out there. So we look at the persistence of the unfinished task, and it challenges to say, can we keep doing it the same way? Is there something else that we need to do if we're going to be the generation that's going to fulfill the Great Commission? So let's look at some of the things. Why are they unreached? Well, people groups are unreached for a number of reasons, but one of those are geopolitical restrictions, where governments make it difficult for a national church, a national believer, to really spread their faith, but also for foreigners, for missionaries to come in and really support that effort and be a part of evangelizing, discipleship, and church planting. So how widespread is that? Well, among the 6,000 or so unreached people groups, you can see about 45% are in areas that are high or very high, meaning that the government makes it very, very difficult for Christian work to go forward. And in most of those places, it makes it very, very difficult for missionaries to come in and be a part of that process in a traditional missions way. In terms of the global population, about 70% of the world lives in areas where it's high or very high. So when we look out over the world, we see most people are living in places in which they are facing difficult restrictions coming from the government. It's a bit like the conversation that Wayne and Barry had this morning as far as free market systems. I mean, most of the world is operating not in a free market system in terms of religion. The government, the communities are making it difficult for people to share their faith with the rest of their people group. So that's the challenge that we face. Now, something else that's going on out there is urbanization and the growing middle class, which may represent an opportunity for us. Now, if we look at urbanization, 1950, about 70% of the world was rural, only 30% urban. Of just a few years ago, we went 50-50, and by 2050, we're expected to be about 70% rural, 30% urban. And so it's kind of changed a little bit of the way that we look at missions, because unprecedented numbers of people are going from the rural, the countryside, into the city. So what does that mean for us? Now, because it's an economic conference, I'm not trying to draw a distinction like more urbanization equals more economic development. That may not be, you know, just get people in cities and things will happen, but typically that is what happens. As you get more economic development, people come into cities because that's where the employment is, that's where the jobs are, that's where the resources get focused. And what that produces is a growing middle class. Right now, they estimate the global middle class is about 2 billion. By 2030, according to one estimate I saw, they expect it to be about 4.9 billion. And so people are coming in, again, unprecedented ways into the middle class. Now, when you come into the cities, what does that give you? That gives you, again, more opportunities for education, employment, comes with problems as well. But again, we have to think in terms of an urban strategy more and more when we think about missions and the fact that more and more of those people are going to be in the middle class. The bulk of that will be coming in Asia because that's where the people are. Okay, so if I try to plot those two things together and I look at restrictions on freedom of religion, and I look at socioeconomic classes, where up here do you see that traditional missions is going to be more effective and more of a driver? Which of those four quadrants can we say, we're, you know, It's still going to be effective to be going at it in terms of an open, traditional missions standpoint. Yeah, and what happens in an open environment with lower reaching the lower classes? Why is that an advantage for most Christian agencies?
People have needs and social needs. So if you're meeting those needs, they're more willing to listen.
Okay. And I mean, that's kind of been a sweet spot, hadn't it, for Christian missions. We're really good at going in, meeting the needs of the poor, and again, in an open environment, a lot of freedom to share the gospel in doing that. What about in terms of the middle and upper socioeconomic in an open environment? Which would you rather have, traditional missions or maybe a marketplace approach where people are coming in and working in the marketplace? What's the advantage of the marketplace?
Well, with the marketplace, you're meeting the people you're reaching where they're doing work and where they're doing yards.
Yeah, in some ways you cut down the distance a little bit because you're already in the marketplace. And then we'll talk a little bit more about what that advantage looks like. Can you still have traditional missions in that area as well? Yeah, in an open country, there's opportunities. Again, oftentimes people in the middle and upper classes are attending the national church. And so there's still a role for, again, coming alongside a national church and being able to do that in an open environment. What about reaching the lower classes in a restricted environment? Is that more of the job of a traditional mission approach, or is that more of a marketplace?
There are some traditional approaches that have functioned well as far as giving Bibles and educational programs that are kind of underground. I'm not sure if that was what you were asking.
Yeah, that's pretty much, and I think even in a restricted access country, there's still often among the lower classes, they look the other way a little bit more. If they're really poor, anybody who's going to come to help them is going to bring back. So they're going to kind of be a little more free, they're going to open the door a little bit more, even if it's a Christian organization working among lower classes in a restricted area. What about marketplace? Do they have a role reaching the poor in a restricted access country? And I could define, yeah, marketplace as being NGOs, community development, micro enterprise, all again, not necessarily under the label of a Christian mission organization, but again, being very intentional about what they're doing. So again, we could see a role for both of those in restricted access. What about reaching the middle and upper classes in a closed country? What's going to be most effective there? The correct answer is the name of the workshop. Yeah, the marketplace. And so what's the advantage there? And by the way, you guys did great. You got 4 for 4 on that. What's the advantage of the marketplace? Or the disadvantage of traditional mission approaches?
One of the ones that I've talked with some students about from people who have come from the field is that there are some circumstances where the people in the country just wonder, you know, where are your resources coming from that you don't need to work, that you just seem to be available at all times to meet and things like that. And so one of the advantages of the marketplace is that you're working alongside people. Not only here's the way that I can contact them, but also some credibility in your being there, and it just shows that you are doing something just like they are doing something. You're kind of on the same level as far as that goes.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in just a minute about the confused identities. But yeah, it's almost like you're right there again, right there with people. And again, in a restricted access country, there's really not a great option for traditional missions. If you're coming in and saying, I want to be a missionary here, it's really not available to you. So the marketplace becomes really both a good option and your only effective option there. Now, if we're looking at the future, going forward, do we think the world is going to become less restricted? Do we think the world is going to become a more favorable place for the gospel witness? I mean, in this country, I don't think people feel all that excited about the way it's going in this country. So we think globally, is it going to become more restricted or less restricted? Probably more restricted, right? Now, I just mentioned a minute ago, in terms of the growth, in terms of socioeconomic, what group is really going to be growing in the next generation? The middle class. So if you're looking at, if this was a business strategy class, Scott, and I was saying, where do I want to go if I've got the competencies to do that? Which quadrant is going to be where the growth is going to happen? Yeah, and so that's kind of what's driving part of it. So that's the demand side of this. That's why we feel the urgency and the critical nature. We've got to get the marketplace involved. So what's the supply side of that look like? And that brings us to confused identities and a bit of what Ken was just talking about. Now, this didn't surprise people. I mean, mission agencies have been looking at this for a generation at least. I mean, they looked at the globe and said, there are huge parts of the world out there that we're not even touching because we can only go in there as traditional missionaries. And so they started out with doing things like non-residential missionaries, where they were outside the country, they travel in, they try to get a feel for what's going on, develop a strategy from the outside. They said, we've got to do more. And so they began putting missionaries in there, but they came in there not as missionaries, but with a marketplace identity. And it's been an incredible experience. And we learned a few things. One, and again, to Ken's point, that when you go in as a marketplace person, you have a different kind of conversation with people. They view you differently than if they see you as there as part of a church or a seminary. You're a little bit more like them. You're an engineer, I'm an engineer. And also you get to see, so that's what it looks like for an engineer to demonstrate their faith, to live out their faith in the same context that I'm in, where it's a little bit harder, just like in this country, to identify completely with a pastor if you're not a pastor. The other thing that we learned was that mission agencies weren't particularly good at starting and operating businesses. And some of that was when we started this experiment, there was still a bit of a mindset that said, you know, you really want to minimize the amount of time you put into your business because you're really there to do discipleship, church planting, evangelism, and the work is just going to take you away from that. Now, if you read many business books or successful biographies of successful business people, most of them didn't go into their business saying, I want to minimize the amount of time I spend on my business. You know, if I could just spend 10 hours a week on this, that would be great. Scott, do we have a lot of examples of that? Very few. Yeah, that's generally not a formula for success. And so that was part of the issue. And again, we're trying to move away from that. But initially, that was not a good place to start. The other, and to Ken's point a little bit, it was a little odd because your identity when you came into a country was, I'm here, I've got a travel agency, I'm operating an import-export business or something. But it's like you didn't really do a lot of business. And so it just kind of looked odd to everybody that you didn't really need to produce a lot to live there. I still remember visiting a missionary one time, and he was operating a business. And so we were there to kind of talk to him about it as business. And we went down to the part of town where he had his office, and he couldn't find his office. I mean, he just didn't go there enough to actually, you know, we circled. And so he's an incredible evangelist, but, you know, he just wasn't really into the business thing. The other challenge was the sense of a lot of people that were being sent out really weren't trained to do that. They weren't expecting that. They didn't have experience in what they were being asked to do. And so there were a lot of confused identities, and people just didn't feel like there was a good fit, and there wasn't a lot of alignment in there. And so, again, the whole business's missions is trying to push more into the idea of there's a real advantage to having a real business, to being credible in what you're doing. But even if mission agencies were great at doing this, the need for marketplace people to be all the places, that we look at that chart, you know, 6,000 unreached people groups. I mean, mission agencies just can't recruit, fund, and manage all the marketplace people that are needed. And so where does the other group come from? And fortunately, God has a plan. God has been preparing people for a long time. He's given them education, he's given them experience, he's given them jobs and professions that they really enjoy and they're authentic, and those people are sitting in the pews, hopefully slightly more alert than the guy in on the screen here. But the idea is that there are people who they don't have this divide, they don't have this, you know, confused identity, that they see themselves, they've been trained, they've been equipped, and so they really represent God's plan for how they can reach the nation. We're talking earlier before the session started, and this isn't something new. I mean, in Acts, when the church gets persecuted, you know, the elders stay behind, but everybody else scatters. And what do they do? Is they scatter, they share their faith. So it's always been about, as people go, the opportunity to share. So what's the challenge here? So part of it, we said, we need to see a significant increase. We need to see the strategic involvement. What's holding people back? And I was talking to a missions professor, a guy who has been really on the forefront of business's missions for a long time. He said that the biggest challenge we have, the nut we have to crack, the thing if we could get past, we could unleash all these people, is the sacred-secular divide. This idea that God calls certain people to go into ministry and the rest of us are just kind of on the sidelines. And when he was telling me that, I thought, well, you know, is that really it? Because I've never been to a church in which at the end of the sermon, the pastor said, you know, I shared with you some really powerful things today, some amazing things. Grace, forgiveness, God's love, but let's don't tell anybody. And whatever you do, please don't invite anybody to come next week. Let's just kind of keep this among ourselves. I mean, it's always been about sharing your faith and going, but I thought about how we do have this idea there's certain people that are called to be pastors and missionaries. And others of us just have this free reign. We get to do whatever we want to do. And some of it is the language that we use. Because growing up, I would hear pastors come and visit our house, and they would say things like, I surrendered to the call. I yielded to the ministry. And as a kid, it was a little scary. You know, what does that mean? Because I never heard an accountant or a teacher or a lawyer say, you know, my sophomore year, I surrendered to the call to be a marketing manager. I mean, that didn't make sense to me. So we do have this sort of embedded idea that there are certain jobs and certain callings that are really special and the others are not. And so we get past that until everybody sees that they really have an opportunity to participate. And, you know, the Great Commission, again, was given to everybody. And while there are different roles, and certainly being called to a shepherd of a church is a specific calling that God has for you, it really doesn't excuse everybody else. And in fact, you play an important role in it if you're a marketplace person. And so hopefully the marketplace person, as they think about this, it's not like they're plan B. It's not like they're up in the stands, they're the last guy on the bench, but they're part of God's plan, and they're expected to, you know, the coach needs them to have the game of their life at this point. And it's game time. It's time to be involved in that. So hopefully, have I convinced you? You're all on board with this. Okay, so I can move on to the next. So what's the question now? If you're sitting here and you're kind of going, yes, this is important. I am plan A. This is part of God's plan. What's the question? How? Thank you. You guys were paying attention at the beginning. Let me show you a quick video here, though. I kind of jumped ahead of this. Whoops. This kind of just tries to capture for people to look at it a little bit differently about themselves, how they're equipped to do this. Hopefully this is loud enough. What did anything resonate in that other than when the guy said solving equations filled my, I don't think I ever got there, but anyway, what? That's right, you're right. So what does that say? What does that say to us? As far as a marketplace person, yeah.
God has gifted each one of us for the purpose. He knew, you know, sovereignty, he could save us. He's given us those gifts for a purpose.
Yeah.
We're in that
career
than that.
Right. As opposed to what we've seen so often is God's calling me to the ministry. That means I leave my job, I go to seminary, I pastor a church, and then I go overseas to work or whatever. This would say God's created you and gifted you to use what you've been doing, but just do it intentionally and do it where he calls you to do it. Okay, well, let me go to some ways that we see people living this out. Six pathways, we'll touch on them real quickly. Again, we see marketplace professionals fulfilling the Great Commission in these general pathways. One is being the intentional traveler or the frequent global traveler. I mean, with the global economy, people are traveling all the time. But if we contrast a mission trip with a business trip, everybody been on a mission trip before? Mission trip? And this is the way sort of I picture it for a marketplace professional. The pastor announces the church is going on a mission trip. And the guy's kind of like, huh, mission trip. I've never been on one of those. But somehow God kind of, you know, keeps that in front of his mind. He kind of deals with it during the week. And then he mentions something to his wife, you know, we did that mission trip. And then the wife says, yeah, maybe you ought to consider going. And so he goes to the pastor and he says, tell me a little bit about this mission trip. And the pastor says, I think you'd be great to go. And the guy's like, me? On a mission trip, I could go? And so he gets all excited. He joins the team. they begin to meet together and pray together. He's learning about what's going on. The church is praying for him. And then right before they get on the airplane, the whole church prays for him and sends them out. How does this guy feel? His very first mission trip. He gets on that plane and he is going to run through a brick wall for Jesus, right? And the whole time that he's on that mission trip, he is so intentional. He's alert. He's just the whole time. It is a spiritual high for this guy. Now, how does that compare when he goes on a mission trip to the same unreached people group? Is it the same intentionality? It's a business trip. Boss asked me to go on a business trip. I'm thinking about business, business, business. I pack my stuff. I go. I have my meetings. I come back. And yet, he had the same opportunity. As he traveled over there, oftentimes when you travel internationally, there are people from that country who are coming back. They may speak English because they were in this country. Opportunities to share there. The people that the taxi ride from the airport or the guy meeting you at the hotel oftentimes speaks English. A chance to share there at the hotel. The people you're going to meet with, your clients, your teammates, the colleagues that are there. All of those are opportunities that the frequent traveler has if he's intentional about that. And it's really interesting that the guys, there's one guy that works with Exxon who's really an intentional traveler. He just talks about, I mean, before he goes. I mean, he's asking people to pray for him. He's really preparing himself for the opportunity. When he travels to the same places, he's asking for the same driver. He's staying in the same hotel. He's visiting the same restaurant so he can continue to build relationships with people. You know, as somebody who is a world-class introvert, after I've spent all day doing something, I just want to go back to the hotel room and turn out, you know, the world. But he's like, those opportunities after work when people want to sit around and talk and go to dinner, what a great time to share. So it really changes the nature of how you view these business trips because, people are going all the time and are they using those intentionally? So the frequent global traveler, the intentional traveler, is one pathway we see. Expanding your business globally, again, this is for business owners, business decision makers. It's not necessarily about moving overseas, but as you think about your business, how can I, as I'm participating in the global economy, how can I expand to places that make both business sense and strategic sense from a mission standpoint? We've had a number of wonderful business people who have come to missionaries and they've said, look, we know that you need a business reason to be in that country. And I've got a business here and I'll provide the paperwork and you can go to that country and set up a business. And who knows, maybe you'll even sell something. You know, but they're really not doing it because there's a business reason. They just want to help and some great things have happened. It's given people access. They've been able to go into places. But it kind of, again, goes back to the point Ken mentioned. It kind of places in people a situation where they've opened a business in which there is no business, really. I mean, nobody else does that. And so after a while, it becomes a little bit of a problem because I'm publicly, my identity is this, but there's really no business that's out there. And so what we're saying is make good business decisions. But also think, if I've got to open a factory somewhere, if I'm going to open a rep office somewhere, where can I open it that would really make sense in terms of reaching a people group, in terms of working with a mission strategy? I got a report just last month from a guy in Asia, and one of the guys he was working with was there in that country, basically a well-meaning, believing businessman had given him the paperwork to open a rep office for him. And he really didn't expect anything for him. It's just he was helping the guy out. Well, the businessman from the States goes and visits the guy and just gets a vision for the needs of the believers there. And he says, you know, I have a business here. We have to buy product from around the world. Why don't we buy product from there? Why don't we open a factory there? And if we do that, think of all the influence we can have in that community. And so this is what I mean when we say expand the business globally. Think strategically. And again, a great opportunity, because when you come into a business, come into a country, and you're opening a business, you have a lot of influence, you have a lot of opportunity. Again, when people see that you're operating something that's creating jobs, that's bringing value to the community. The third pathway is one in which we normally think of, the idea of going overseas and getting a job. And there are two probably general pathways in this. One is you're working for a multinational company, and they transfer you. And oftentimes that's a 2 or 3 year assignment. It's just part of your, it could be part of your development, you know, get that international experience. Maybe you have a particular skill set that's needed overseas. And this oftentimes is a great way to go because you have a lot of logistical support. You step in. Oftentimes you're part of a well-recognized company in the community. People know you, or they know your company. And so it's an easy way logistically and relationally to get into a community. The other general pathway we see is people directly getting jobs. And I mean, probably the most common way over the years has been people getting English teaching jobs, or working at an international school, something like that. But we do see in some developing economies, as they've developed their own multinational companies, they are looking for specific skills that that people from this country can offer there. It may be in IT, it may be in engineering. One field that we see a tremendous opportunity in a particular part of the world is healthcare. In Saudi Arabia, I think it was in 2007, they spent about $8 billion on healthcare. Last year, they spent $27 billion on healthcare. In some ways, it's almost like their attempt to appease the population is to love them with healthcare. And so they're opening dozens of hospitals in that part of the world. Met with somebody last month, and they were taking a job over in that part of the world. They said, my whole hospital is new. I mean, they're looking for everything in there. So if you're a health, I mean, there are entire websites that are devoted to healthcare jobs in that part of the world. So that's another way to go into those places. One of the challenges is that when you go in, oftentimes as an expat marketplace professional, is to make sure you don't step into the expat bubble. You know, it's just easy to kind of, if you're in a big enough group, to kind of you spend most of your time with other expats. My experience overseas was doing a lot of management training, so I would do events for multinational organizations. And we'd do the event, and then afterwards there'd be a social event. And so, you know, I'd maybe finish getting my computer stuff put up. And by the time I walked into the social room, to the left of me was the expats, to the right of me were the nationals. And it was just a weird, because, I mean, you know, especially if you spent all day doing a team building exercise and they're still, you know, like separated. And it's just interesting because oftentimes as the outsider in the organization, the conversations I have with the expats are, boy, you should try working with these nationals. To the nationals, it's like these guys, these expats, they don't really know, they understand. So it is a great opportunity if you are the expat to be the guy who is going to invest in the lives of the nationals and show interest in them. So just because you're there doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be intentional. So it does take effort even if you're with a company overseas. The fourth one is somewhat similar, is the idea of moving overseas and living there, but it's to start your own business. Now this is probably, well, let me just ask this question. What's the advantage of being an expat entrepreneur? If you go overseas and start your own business, what's the advantage of that? Okay, a little more flexibility because you're working for yourself. What else?
You're not necessarily limited by bosses who want to.
Yeah, I mean, a huge challenge, I think, in certain parts of the world is there's this sense of I'm working for an organization and they're really paying attention to the conversations I'm having, how I'm spending my time. And so if it's your own company, you have more freedom, more flexibility. You can determine a little bit more maybe of the company culture. You just have more the things you want to talk about in your meetings and that kind of thing. So you have a lot more flexibility. I mean, I think this in some ways from a mission organization standpoint would love to see, you know, thousands of Christian businesses being started. Well, I was in India last year and they said we need a business planting movement. Not just a church planting movement, but a business planting movement. Part of that is just to help find jobs for all the Indian believers that are out there. But what's the challenge of being an expat entrepreneur? Now, in this country, the failure rates, Scott, you probably know this, maybe it's 120% or something, not quite that high, but it's pretty high in this country. You know.
Well, it depends on how you draw your lines, but like 1 in 10 ideas makes it to the launch stage, and then from there, you know, about 50 make it a year.
So it's not overwhelmingly, yeah. And so that's in this country where you speak the language, culture, the government is fairly transparent. And you go overseas, and you didn't go to high school or college with anybody you're going to try to do business with. You know, the language and culture, is we've talked about in the main sessions, the governments are going to make it more difficult. And so there are a lot of challenges to being an expat entrepreneur over there. I mean, it really is an all-in. That's what I talked about earlier. The idea that you're going to go in and start a business in a foreign country and be successful and put in a minimum amount of time is just not going to happen. It's also something you see sometimes people come in and it's like, I've always wanted to run a travel agency, but they really don't know how to run the business, and then they do that and they go to another country. So again, that sense of you understand your business model, you've got some expertise, you can recruit the kind of people you need, all those things are going to be critical in terms of being able to be a successful entrepreneur, especially in a foreign country. But again, the payoff, the opportunity is huge. And I think in a lot of countries, they really see entrepreneurship as the ticket out. You know, so if we have all a bunch of entrepreneurs, you know, well, the economy will grow. And so again, if you're a successful entrepreneur in a country, lots of opportunities. And we see that in some countries where guys coming in, usually they bring a very strong industry-specific skill to it. They've thought it through. They've thought about the kind of money they need. They've recruited a team to do that. And again, it's been very business-focused on that, but they clearly have a mission strategy that goes with it. Okay, the fifth pathway, we see students going abroad. When I went on college tours with my kids a couple years ago, every college was promoting their international study abroad program. And so just a lot of opportunities for students to get overseas and have that experience. And a great opportunity, one, for the students to get exposed to it, but again, the opportunity to be around college students from other cultures, other religions. I mean, it's just a great time when people are asking questions. Also, for student internships, to work overseas, either during their college years or right after. There are organizations that promote that kind of thing. So that's an opportunity as well that we see. And then we talked about mission trips a minute ago. Another way to do mission trips, and people do wonderful things on mission trips. They build things. They look after kids. They do friendship evangelism. But another way to do a mission trip is to use your marketplace skills. Because there are a lot of places around the world where missionaries or marketplace people are trying to launch businesses, and they really need the kind of skill sets that marketplace people can bring to them. Help them think through their marketing plan, help them get their books set up, or just bring credibility to them. If you're a small business and an economy and you can bring in somebody who's an executive from overseas and say, this is one of my advisors, that gives you some credibility. We partnered with a large, well-known Christian company in the quick service industry here, the food service, and they would send over their managers to do leadership workshops. They would talk about their leadership model, and it just seemed really effective because they would come into a country that was closed, but they would just begin to talk about what had made this organization successful, and people wanted to know that. But you could always tell just because of who the people were and the message that they had, the people that stayed around after the workshop was over, that really wanted to build that relationship, were people that were looking for something even more than just good management tips. And so again, it's an opportunity for marketplace people, kind of as a first step as well. Go on a mission trip using your marketplace skill, that may be the first step to finding a longer-term path to be there. So those are six pathways, again, that we see marketplace people are using to be intentional about using their skills. Any questions on those? We'll give you time for questions in a minute, but any that fairly clear? I mean, it's not an exhaustive list, but again, just common ways that we see marketplace people going overseas.
That NGO is a popular one, too.
The which one?
NGO is another really good. It's not on there, but...
Number seven. Yeah, okay. Which is going over to be, yeah, more with an NGO, community development type projects, yeah. And I did want to make one quick comment before we move to the last part. Sometimes when you're trying to make the case for one thing, it sounds like you're diminishing the other a little bit. And there's still, you know, needs for traditional missionary approaches. Hopefully that was clear in that one discussion that we had. But part of the issue is that 10 years ago with the International Mission Board, about 40% of the missionaries we sent out had to go into countries as something other than missionaries, and they had to have another identity. That number now is about 70%. And so that is the trend in missions that more and more, and again, there's still debate about what that needs to look like, but in more and more places, there really is a desire to match the right people, to make sure that job they're going to have to do is going to be a good fit for them. Because that is going to be a significant part of their ministry, is being able to work effectively in the marketplace. So that is part of the issue. But I think the message is that if you're looking at preparing yourself to go overseas, thinking bivocational is probably not a bad idea. You know, think, you know, what else can I need to do? And I think a lot of times people feel a sense of like I have to have a whole different set of education and experiences, and that may be helpful. But a lot of times the things that you've done, even in a ministry setting, have prepared you for marketplace activities. And you can kind of look at the skill sets you've developed in ministry, and you may see that there's some good fits out there in the marketplace as well. So it's not necessarily like I've got to stop what I'm doing and go get a completely different career path. Let me talk about next steps real quick. And the main next step I want to do, and I've got a little handout that I'll give you before we leave, is to talk about SkyBridge Community, which was really set up to help marketplace people. Because when you go with a mission agency, you get a lot of support. You get orientation. You get training. You get to the field. You're part of a team. You have a mentor. You have a supervisor. Oftentimes when you go as a marketplace professional, is your company going to provide that? If you're going overseas with General Electric, are they going to give you a four-week course on how to evangelize cross-culturally? Probably not. Yeah. And also, you go over there and you're going to feel perhaps isolated. Well, SkyBridge Community was set up so as marketplacers think about going, as they awaken to the possibilities of what they could do, they can step into a community of people that are marketplacers. People who are asking the same questions, people who are also in the marketplace doing these things, that they can feel that connection and then get equipped. So SkyBridge Community is it's a global community, is online. I mean, there's a website that you can be a part of, but also it meets geographically in countries as well. So this is, I always say, people, if this is something you're interested in, or there are people that are saying, what I'm thinking about the marketplace, SkyBridge Community is kind of a natural first step, because that's where there are a lot of other people that you can connect with and learn from them as well. Okay?